Listener Production.
Today, I want to introduce you to one of the most delightful human beings I've had the opportunity to meet on this show. She's smart, humble, kind, and she is passionate about using her voice to inspire others. Maria Fertil was propelled into the spotlight when she was crowned Miss Universe Australia in 2020. She then went on to place in the top 10 of the international competition in 2021 and was only the third woman of colour to represent Australia in the pageant's 69-year history. Maria is the queer child of South Asian immigrants and she grew up in suburban Melbourne, so she knows what it is like to struggle with belonging. She now is a fierce activist for social causes and she uses her platform to champion critical social justice issues, including anti-racism, diversity, inclusion, mental health, and gender equality. Like I said, she is also a delight. She invited me for dinner at her house, and if I didn't live in London and she lives in Melbourne, I would have already taken her up on that. I really think that you're going to love Maria just as much as I do. Here is that conversation. Maria, welcome to the Crappy to Happy podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. You've been just such a radiant ray of sunshine since I've just started chatting to you. So I'm very excited to be here.
I'm thrilled to have you. I speak to the most interesting people on this show. I'm very fortunate, but I would have to say you are my first Miss Universe. So I'm feeling quite honored.
Oh, I feel very, very special being the first Miss Universe on your podcast. Hope I just make you very excited to speak to more Miss Universes after this.
Indeed, I'm sure you will. So Maria, on that, I guess, you know, on the face of it, anybody looking at you publicly, you are obviously beautiful. Miss Universe got into the top 10 of the Miss Universe, like globally, is my understanding, yeah. Right? You have now written a book. You are highly educated. You are like kicking goals in some, you know, big spaces in the world. Anybody looking at you would just go, wow, what an accomplished, confident young woman. But clearly it hasn't always been that way for you. You had to overcome your own internal obstacles to get to where you are now, which is the topic of your new book, Unbounded. And I was fascinated to read your story and really excited to talk to you about that.
Thank you.
So can we just start with, Maria, what was your experience like, I guess, you know, growing up as a South Asian child of immigrants, suburban Melbourne, sort of one foot in each of two very different cultures? How was that for you as a child?
Yeah, well, I'll start by saying that's a very generous, very, very generous introduction to your audience. So thank you, Cass. I guess when I, on the face of it, to be Miss Universe Australia, that in itself is such a big deal as a South Asian child of immigrants, because, you know, I grew up in the 90s and the very early 2000s. And so at the time, diversity wasn't just celebrated. It was kind of only ever really seen through a lens of super toxic caricatures or exaggerated stereotypes. And so the way that I experienced the world was I'd go to school and I so desperately wanted to fit in with my peers who were, you know, if they were white, they were Aussie, you know, that was it. But I'd go home and I was surrounded and immersed in really rich culture from food, music, clothes, the accent and languages that my parents spoke. But it, to me, it felt like an anchor as a child, because it was like the thing that was stopping me from really fitting in with my peers. And so you go to school, and the way that people interpret you is through your skin. And so at the time, Apu from The Simpsons was probably the most prominent representation we had. So I would get everything from, you know, okay, does your dad own a 7-Eleven? Does your mom wear the red dot? Do they bob their heads when they talk? And that's how people understood you. And when you're a kid, you think, okay, something must be wrong with me, because otherwise people wouldn't be saying it. You know, you're a naive, childlike mind. And I also internalized a lot of these sensibilities. So it made me think that in order to be Australian, I needed to shed my ethnicity, even though that makes me me. That's my rich roots. But I thought, I've got to part ways with that if I want to belong and to fit in and be Australian enough. And so it really caused a divide between my family and I when I was growing up. My cousins, who I was so close to, stopped speaking to them. I started, you know, bleaching my skin with products that sadly to this day are still on the market. And it was all kinds of things like going blonde, wearing blue eye contacts. And at the time I didn't realize it, but I was trying to wear skin that wasn't mine because, you know, growing up as a South Asian child of immigrants, you think that you need to be somebody else to be good enough. And I think that message of being enough, I was bound to so many beliefs in other areas, like, you know, to do with sexuality, with faith, things like that, that just basically the underlying message was, here's a blueprint. If you don't fit it, you ain't it. So that's what it was like. I think I just spent a lot of time trying to chameleon myself into a lot of different spaces. And it makes me really sad to look back on. But with the book, I wrote about it because I think there are going to be a lot of people who read it. And not just kids, I think adults and people will read it and they will give themselves permission to unbind themselves from those beliefs.
What you're talking about there, that whole, if I'm this, I'm not enough, is so, like you said, for you, it was culture, there was sexuality. Obviously, we haven't even talked about the fact that your dad was a former Catholic priest. And that whole, I mean, I went to Catholic school. And so I'm all that original sin, and you're just born as a sinner and you spend your life trying to, you know, get over that.
And you would remember that's from the chapter, chapter two in the book, you remember something I said about prayers, how I was like, why are we saying this? Yes. Why am I saying, I'm a kid, you know?
And reciting the prayers also, not even knowing what the prayers really mean, which it's just autopilot. Yeah. And I also, on that, I used to work a lot in, well, not that you necessarily needed to work a lot in Asian countries, but I just used to travel back and forth to Japan, Korea, Taiwan, places like that in my 20s for my work. And I used to see that whitening, the skin whitening products like all over the shelves. It always seemed, to me, it just seemed like how odd that all of the white girls so desperately want to be
brown.
And all of the brown girls apparently just like torturing themselves to try to be more.
Well, I think, you know, if there's one thing, it doesn't matter where in the world you are, but skin tone is weaponized for social privilege. And within Asian communities and brown communities like ours, there's a phenomenon called colorism where social privilege is allocated to those with fairer skin because, you know, historically those with fairer skin, you know, India, for example, colonized. A lot of those communities colonized. So there were a lot of Anglo-centric ideas about beauty. And so when you come to countries like this, being darker typically has been associated with being able to holiday and this and that and the other. But also there's beauty standards which change all the time. You know, what's in vogue today won't be that tomorrow. And I just think the message for so many people always is, if you do this, you'll be beautiful enough. If you do that, you'll be good enough, pure enough, this enough. And that's the whole point of this book. It's to get people to identify that and go, actually, I'm not buying this. Whatever I've got, that's enough. It's good enough. So I think, but it was only through these experiences that I was able to unpack and understand my own identity, really. So
I work with women across all ages, and this concept, this whole sense of not being enough, like that, for many people continues throughout their life. Women are still struggling and, you know, jumping through hoops and trying to fix themselves and change themselves in order to be enough well into their 40s, 50s and beyond. So it's actually quite impressive, Maria, that you have come to, like you have sort of unpacked this, and you really have really unpacked this and worked this out on your own at the age that you have. I'm curious to know, what was the, in the meantime, what were the things that you were doing or trying to do in order to overcome that not enoughness? Like, what were some of the things or the paths that you went down in life to try to be enough to prove yourself?
I can very distinctly pinpoint when it started changing for me in my 20s. And I really value your opinion, I think your professional opinion, because I know you've read the book and so you know I have unpacked it. And so I think for me, you know, yes, it was years of, I guess, subscribing to really, really, really self-limiting beliefs based on racism and homophobia and a lot of religious dogma, a lot of it, and other things as well in terms of, you know, I went to uni, I did super well at uni, you know, was then expected to, oh, are you going to do a PhD? Are you going to do the corporate job? And so The further along I started going down this path based on, okay, this is what people expect me to do and be, the unhappier I was. And it was in 2019 where I sort of hit a bit of a crossroads. And I really think of this chapter in my life as being the turning point, which ironically was when everything fell apart. And this is where I hope, if you're listening to this, ironically, we're on the Crappy to Happy podcast, really, really reevaluate and just open your mind up to thinking of that really crappy moment, because it could be the thing that changes everything. So I was 26 years old. I was living with my then partner who, you know, I have a lot of love and respect for till this day. We are not together anymore, but he's a good man. It just didn't work out. And I was closeted and very, you know, confused. And I was very unhappy in my corporate job as well, and five figures in debt, like a lot of debt. I just had no financial literacy, no idea what I wanted to do. And I was constantly spending money on things to buy other people's perceptions of me. When we moved into this great apartment, oh, right, yep, I'll put the amazing marble coffee table on my credit card just because I want people to look like I have it together, right? And so that eventually just led me into a very bad financial place. And I just felt in my gut that it was time for the relationship to end. I felt it for a while, but got the courage, and that ended. And I moved back home with my parents with debt and a job that I hated. And I literally moved into the corner room of their house that was so small that all it fit was my bed and a lampshade on the floor. And I had two of my brother's wardrobes in there. So my brother often jokes, "You were sleeping in my wardrobe." And like, for me, it was just this point of, what am I doing? How have I gotten to this point? What is next? But one thing I was starting to do was create content online. And it wasn't a time when social media was a thing and people were getting paid all the time. It was just starting to come up. But I used to love putting out beauty content just for the fun of it. I just enrolled in makeup qualification. And at the time, I'd also graduated from a master's degree with first class honors. And so while I was doing that makeup certification, a lot of people roll their eyes at me and they were like, "Oh, like, you're going to be a makeup girl. Like, what are you doing? You're at Melbourne Uni. Why are you doing that sort of thing?" And even my friends, you know, some of them didn't understand the posting content online. They thought it was vain or vapid. But for me, it brought joy. Like, I was creating all these creative makeup looks and I was just doing it, putting it out there. And slowly I started integrating messages about diversity and a lack of it in the beauty industry. And slowly, slowly, it started to attract a community of people who were like, "Oh my God, me too. I haven't felt heard. And that's what I think. I'm so glad someone's saying it." And it was almost like social media was this place where I didn't need anyone's permission to say the thing or do the thing that made me happy. And the more I did it, the more I attracted a community. And suddenly I started to think, actually, where can I push this? Where can I do this? And it was tough because a lot of people in my corporate job at the time kind of looked down on it a little bit, and it was a bit condescending, but I had a vision for it, albeit it wasn't as big as what I'm doing now. I just thought I can grow it, and then when I have a platform, I can talk to people about these issues, and how great would that be? So I think it was kind of having a space to slowly start doing my thing safely, and when it started to just really like spark my soul. So I guess for anyone who's listening, and if you're a little bit lost and you're like, what do I do? Try everything, whether it's journaling, maybe you post something online, maybe you take a cooking class. And if it starts to spark joy, just follow it. One foot in front of the other, just follow that thing and just be open to where it leads you. I didn't know my stuff would lead me here. When I was doing makeup qualification, I wanted to be a beauty blogger back in the day, but here we are doing all this other stuff. So I think that's the power of following what sparks you.
I think there is so much in what you just said. First of all, you know, achieving at university, relationship that looks great on the outside, lovely apartment. I think many people find themselves in exactly the same place that you found yourself, Maria. Like on the outside, it all looks so
amazing.
Amazing. Such a shiny life. I've been there in my 20s, and it takes courage. Like it really does take some courage to walk away from something that, you know, people will look at you and go, what, why? Like what? How can you not be happy? And the other thing, I guess, is that, you know, even putting stuff out online, I mean, like you said, social media then perhaps wasn't what it is now, but in fact, what you're talking about is probably really the best of social media, isn't it? Like the when it was really
just green and everyone was
positive and happy and community. Now everybody's just ripping each other to
now
pieces.
It's a bit, it's evolved a little, but it was a nicer time. And it was like the era of like beauty tutorials. And it was, but it's so true. It's like, and you're talking about courage. It's like, I know so many people have that where they're in the life that's comfortable and it's comfortable enough, right? Like it's comfortable enough. It's really freaking hard to walk away from a person you love and a life you are kind of like, okay, I'm okay here, you know, for the unknown. And it's really scary to put yourself out there on social media in a time when one, or like to put yourself out there in any activity, especially if those around you are kind of going, what are you doing? Like, this isn't you. What are you doing? So I think it does take courage. But do you know what was scarier to me? I think this is what pushed me. And I think a lot of people, like, if you can not wait till it gets to this point, I think this is a really great tip. But for me, it just got to the point where I was starting to get so miserable that the misery was scarier to me than people judging me. Like, I was so scared of looking back with regrets. I knew that the pain of regret was going to be so much worse than the fear of what if, you know, what if I just try something different? So I had to change.
Yeah.
I had to. I was really unhappy.
What led you to applying for Miss Universe?
Well, truthfully, it was never something I thought I would do. Just because I guess I had my own misconceptions about it, my own internalized misogyny. Like, let me just put my hand up and call myself out. My own internalized misogyny meant that I thought, oh, it's just a beauty pageant. And therefore, I blanketed that perception to all the incredible women that go through it as well. And then the year before me, there was a woman who won in 2019, an Indian Australian lawyer named Priya Sarau. She was Miss Universe Australia. And so when I saw one, an Indian woman, two, a lawyer, I was like, oh my God, maybe I could do it. You know, because at that point, she was only the second woman of color to represent Australia in the pageant's 68-year history. I was the third in 69 years. So when I saw her do it, because she was something different, it made me kind of go, well, maybe I could do it differently too. And maybe I can make people think, you know, differently about it. And there were people in my job, I remember when I was a finalist, who sort of said, your past remarks, like, but you're a feminist, you're smart, why are you doing it? My answer to them is, if you look at how much impact I'm having in my career now versus when I was in a corporate job, that's my answer. I did it because I knew actually I can take something with patriarchal roots and maximize it to serve this purpose of serving others and impacting others. And so it was a no-brainer for me because you know what? Back then and even to this day, no one is, you know, in 2019, no one was running to give a woman of color anything like that, to give her a platform like that and say, you're going to be an author, a TV presenter, big on social media, you're going to go into acting. Have you seen people like me on magazine covers often and doing all the things that I'm doing? It's like no one's rushing to hand this stuff out. So for me, if I see an opportunity, I'm going to take it and I'm going to run with it. So that's what Miss Universe was to me. Thank you. That's what Miss Universe was. And that's what, you know, a lot of people will roll their eyes at young women or men who go on reality shows. But look at someone like Abby Chatfield, who went on The Bachelor, but look at what she does now. So I think, again, it's that step away from that judgment. Don't judge yourself. Don't judge others. Don't judge platforms. And when you're open-minded, you never know what will happen.
So true. And I think people still, you know, I think about Abby Chatfield and the work that she's doing and the career that she has, and there are still people who judge her. And I think that, again, it reflects so much more on the people doing the judging.
Yeah, no, I'm just like, oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Big yes. Oh.
Yeah, there wasn't really a question in that.
I was just like, yes. Wow. I'm like, you could not have said a truer statement.
How did your life change then, Maria? Like, I mean, you won. And, oh, you won in the middle of a pandemic. Like, we were in lockdown.
That to me is crazy.
Well, you were in Melbourne. I wasn't in Queensland.
I'm so happy for you because let me tell you, it wasn't a good time down here.
No. Queensland, we were pretty tough with the borders, but we managed within Queensland. We actually, you know, we were fine. Mm. We were living life as usual. All the sympathy to you guys down in Melbourne. But you went through Miss Universe during lockdown.
Yeah. And you know what, guys, the full scoop is in the book, but I'll tell you this. Having Miss Universe to sort of strive for in lockdown. And also, let's not ignore the privilege of, yes, I was in Melbourne and it was the most lockdown place, but I had the privilege of all of my loved ones were healthy and nobody I knew passed away or got sick. We all kept our jobs. And I think there are a lot of people who are faring a lot worse. But for me, I just felt very grateful to have Miss Universe as my motivator because my competition was pushed back till October 28th of that year. And so the night I won Miss Universe Australia, it was actually only 24 hours that we had been out of the big lockdown. So I literally came out of lockdown the next day, went to the final, and it's like, you're Miss Universe Australia. But it was really tough because I was competing virtually. So I literally was at home in the corner room, mum, dad, my dog, my brother at home, couldn't go to the gym. Couldn't get my hair done
in the corner room
to my parents. And so, do you know what I did though? I took the circumstances. I'm like, right, well, I can't go to events like the other girls in other states. I can't get my hair done, go to the gym, do the whole glam thing. I'm just going to show them what they would get if they picked me. And so I shared my family a lot because we're very close. And my dad was in my content. Like, you know, my dad and I did our walks together. I did a social media series online every week where I created a space where I'd jump on live and chat to people about social, political issues, current affairs, and heaps of people joined that series, got like hundreds of thousands of views. And it was just using the resources at hand. You know, it was like, right, I don't have everything, but I'm just going to show them I'm a resourceful woman. I will do what I can with it. And it ended up being enough because I think they saw the impact and the drive. So it's like, wow, what would she do if she had everything at her disposal? So safe to say it went pretty well. And I'm very grateful that night changed my life.
Yeah. So like what happens after you win a Miss Universe? Like what happens? Then you have this platform for a year, right? While you hold the title?
Technically. So you're Miss Universe Australia for a year. But I'll tell you, like pageant culture all over the world, it's different in different countries. So like Philippines, right. India, it is like their national sport. Like it is a big deal. Like you have a million followers overnight, hundreds of thousands of dollars invested, big teams. Whereas Australia, it's a little bit more chill. We don't really care about pageants over here. So when I won, like I don't even think I had a morning show interview or anything. I don't think anyone even knew. I think there were a lot of headlines because I was different. And so they were like, wow, look at this person who's won Miss Universe Australia. But I had about 8 months and, you know, the directors, I think they're so funny. They were like, we weren't prepared for you because you run before you can walk. But I was like, I sent a massive email the day after and I said, guys, I want to make the most of this platform. These are all the TV networks that I want to be on, the shows I want to be on, magazine interviews I want to give, the topics I want to speak on, because ultimately, beyond just trying to campaign for Miss Universe, I actually want a really long-lasting career in media and advocacy. So I sent them this huge email and they're like, you need to slow down. I'm like, absolutely not. And then I just assembled a team because they were in Perth, so they helped me where they could. But I ended up assembling a team of friends who to this day are my creatives, photographers, videographers, stylists. And I literally like wrote and directed and produced my own like little mini film for Miss Universe. We did all this, you know, incredible campaigning around inclusivity, ended up doing like 14 morning show interviews that year. And it was kind of the first time in a while that you saw Miss Universe on TV so often, like Australia kind of just dropped their interest for a little while. So we just worked really hard at it. And then I went to Miss Universe. So I had to have coaching on my walk. That's probably the most pageanty, I guess, thing that I did, because let me tell you, I couldn't walk. And there really is an art to it. And I love it because now it's not just like walking in a sexy way, which is what people might think. It's how to walk with confidence in your body. And that's a skill that I take into every room and every meeting I walk into now. And so I had 4 days of walk coaching. A few of them were on FaceTime. And the first time I ever walked on a stage was at the Global Miss Universe competition. And I was like, baptism by fire, here we go. So it was fun. I just took every moment in. It was great.
I think there is such an important lesson in that, Maria, in that you can, you know, win the biggest, you know, beauty pageant in Australia, but nothing gets handed to you. Like you, at some point, if you want to make a change, you've got to harness that opportunity. Like as an individual, I think there's probably many people who just assume you know, when you have a podcast or you write a book or, you know, but you've actually got to harness that opportunity and take the lead in your own career, like drive your own.
100%. And I think, you know, if there are any Miss Universe hopefuls or anything like that listening, I get a lot of those women messaging me and they're like, you know, how did you end up having such a fruitful career? And it's like, because every single opportunity was worked for, the book, the TV show, the presenting gigs, like nothing is handed to you, even as a Miss Universe or whatever. And I think in your career, same as you, like with your podcast, you know, reach out to incredible guests. You're the one doing the research and making it as good as it is. I think in life, if you ever get relaxed and start to expect things to come to you, that's when things will change. And I do think when you take that initiative and drive in your own career and in your life, it's going to be incredible. You know, it's, and it has to be that way because I don't think anyone hands you anything in life.
I hope that you're enjoying this conversation and realizing the benefits of positivity in your own life. If you are enjoying the show, please be sure to like and subscribe so that you get notified when new eps drop, and head on over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a rating and review. The world will push us towards doing the things that look good, you know, and it's about the money and the Instagram followers and the success and the public platform. How have you, or guess what practices do you have, or what do you do in life, I guess, to keep you coming back to what is important to you? Because you're so values driven. How do you stay true to, you know, what really matters to you, as opposed to being, you know, pulled away and distracted by all of that other glamorous, you know, things?
Yeah, that is the best question, because Cass, I had a really big moment with that last year. So I think in the last year in particular, a lot has changed in my career, in that the book, there's been a lot more TV opportunities, there'll be acting coming up, which is exciting. And it's like, okay, how amazing, like you're chasing all this stuff. And I had this moment, and you will so be able to pick my brain about this because psychologist. I had this moment of suddenly, like, I've always been a high achiever and very, you know, passionate about doing things that I, you know, just kicking goals and challenging myself. But I started to all of a sudden go, okay, what's next? What's next? What's next? And suddenly I was so focused on chasing what's next that I was starting to lose, hang on a minute, why are you doing all of this in the first place? And also, what is the impact you're trying to have? What is it actually serving? And when you're constantly chasing what's next because you're worried about how it looks, you know, like people are worried about a beautifully curated Instagram feed, like these achievements are like a beautifully curated highlight reel, right? And I felt like I lost myself for a minute. And so the way I really come back to it is, one, I see a great therapist to talk through a lot of the pressures of a very fast-paced and changing career, because I'm very aware that the kind of growth I've had in 2 years is not normal. It's a lot for any person. So I am seeing a therapist, and I go home, switch off, and hang out with my mum, dad, my dog, my brother, eat my mum's home-cooked food, and I talk to my parents, because they keep me grounded. They remind me of where I come from. They remind me of why I chose this career in the first place. My dad always says, leave your footprint. And suddenly I've got perspective again. And my grandma, I pray to my grandma. So she's now my late grandma, Big Mama, who passed last year. And I know she's looking out for me. But she was always very proud of me because of what I was doing and the why behind it. So I think just being really close to these people who remind me, darling, like the shiny things are not you. They're not even, you don't even want them. So just remember that in the fast pace of it all, it's about, you know, just even that one person messaging you and saying, oh, well, what you said or wrote or did, it changed my life in this way. That's why you do it. So, and I've got a beautiful partner now who just keeps me just so grounded and reminds me of why I do what I do and what that means to people. So I'm very blessed in that way to have good people around me.
It did occur to me while I was reading your book, Maria, that I've actually just every other week I record a solo episode of the podcast, and I talk about ideas in psychology that are relevant to people. And I just recorded a solo episode on attachment theory and, you know, secure versus insecure attachment. Mm. And as I was reading your book and you know, reading about the challenges that you had overcome in terms of belonging and religious and upbringing and sexuality, and I thought, you know, the one thing that it seems like you've really got is that secure attachment, that groundedness in a family that, regardless of how challenging it might have been having that that cultural kind of segregation between your Asian culture and your Australian culture, that constant message from your parents that you have that intrinsic self-worth. You know, like we all struggle, we all have confidence issues, but you've got, would you agree, that core kind of sense of being supported,
100%.
That they're there for you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My best friend, I remember one time my best friend of 12 years, she would all sleep over my house when we were, you know, 16, 17. I remember one day my dad, he used to always do this. And when I was a teenager, I was like, Dad, my friends are over. Like, come on, you know. But he'd sit on the edge of my bed and he would come and he'd talk to me. And he'd always have something wise to say. He's like my mentor, right? So he'd sit on the edge of the bed and be like, do things with purpose, beta. Beta in our culture, it means like darling, my sweet child. So do things with purpose and in service, beta. Like he'd say things like that. I remember one day he had a chat like that with my best friend and I. He got up and he left and she had tears in her eyes. And I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, was my dad really annoying? Like, what was it? Like, I'm sorry. And she said, no, like, I don't think you realize how lucky you are to have that. And I realize why you're so confident. It's because he's your inner voice. And so my mum and dad, from when I was little, even 10 years old, I have memories of my dad scooping me up in his arms and saying, you're wise beyond your years. What do you want to do with your life? You can do it. Like, I've constantly had that. Even with our own troubled family dynamics at times, everyone has that, or like cultural issues. It was like, that's a buffer. That's always been there to be like, don't go too far. Don't lose yourself too much. So I'm very lucky to have,
yes, they sound amazing. Yeah. I wanted to grow up in your family when I was reading about your house. Oh, that sounds so fun.
All the music and the food. We should invite you over for a party, Cass. You'd love it.
I live in London now. So it's a long way for me to get to Melbourne. Otherwise, I would be there
in a
minute.
It might take you a while.
When you and Georgie come to London, then you can have me over.
We'll come and visit. Yes.
Maria, we've alluded to the whole sexuality thing for a bit. So your brother is gay, right? Dominic's gay. Mm-hmm. You had only ever dated men, but you knew that there was an interest there in women. Was it for you? Was there a fear there, I guess, about coming out, like having a relationship with a woman, which you now do openly, are in a wonderful supportive relationship with your partner? How scary was it for you, if it was, to do that publicly?
I think it wasn't scary to do it publicly. I was a little bit nervous. Interestingly, even though my parents were so supportive, I was a little bit nervous when I first introduced George to them, and not because I didn't think they would love her, but because it was the first time. One, they've only really ever met two of my partners, a high school sweetheart and my one really long-term relationship. And it was with a really good man. And so I'm like, okay, this is the first time they're meeting a woman that I'm in a relationship with. They loved her. My dog loved her. Everyone loved her. So when I went out publicly with her, I wasn't nervous. It was more just like, oh my God, I'm so excited for the world to see this incredible person, because she is. Like, I've never met anyone like her. And when I was younger, I don't even think it was a fear of being in a relationship with a girl. It's actually worse than that. It's even more primitive than that. When I was growing up, I did not understand sexuality beyond being straight or gay. And so when I had these feelings like crushes on my peers and, you know, making out with my, you know, girlfriends at parties, I was like, well, I'm not gay. I still like guys. So this is obviously just, it's nothing. It must be nothing. But then the nothing was like a more and more and more curious inkling as I got older. So it was even worse because the lack of visibility in education, and we didn't speak about it at home or in religious circles I was in. that lack of education altogether meant I didn't even understand it. So I wasn't just afraid. I was like, oh, this is nothing. It's clearly not nothing. So here we are. So it's very nice to be in a place where I guess I'm just happy. I live my life very publicly. Obviously, George and I protect a lot about our relationship, but it's very nice to know that, you know, there's going to be a queer kid and, you know, even better, like a queer South Asian kid who will pick up, say, Stella magazine from January and look at that and see us on the cover and go, oh my God, you know, like that's okay. And that exists and that's fine. Or they'll read the book and be like, I resonate with that. You know, I went through that. Even if you're 40, 50, 60, and you're closeted and figuring it out, I'm sure you'll resonate with something I've written in that chapter on sexuality, because I feel like we're only very recently getting to a place where we're celebrating and celebrating and celebrating the community. Mm. And there's still a long way to go. Yeah. So,
how was it having those religious messages about, you know, sex? We all had them, sex before marriage and homosexuality is a sin. Your dad was a former Catholic priest. Now, obviously he left the church, but he's still Catholic, right? Your parents were still very religious as you were growing up.
Yeah.
They're obviously, as you said, very supportive of you.
They're very, very supportive now. Well, now they understand everything
And I guess, and this might have to, we'll have to wrap this up in a minute, Maria, but many people who have that religious upbringing ultimately reject religion because they can't live a life that is in complete contradiction to the teachings of some of those very traditional religions. How have you come to find your own, you're still a spiritual person. So what's your kind of concept of God or spirituality now?
Yeah, I think I understand why a lot of people completely turn away. I think for me, when it comes to religion, yes, there are certain hypocrisies and things that don't make sense to me that I cannot align myself with. But in the book, just as I do with, you know, how I talk about, say, certain family experiences, I can appreciate the good in some of my religious upbringing, like the values for community and love one another, even if it's not practiced that way. But I appreciate those values, but I do not subscribe to any organized religion. Just as I've said, for example, I have had experiences with intergenerational trauma, but it doesn't mean that my entire childhood and upbringing and family experiences were bad. Things can, you know, mutually exist. So I think for religion, the way I like to, you know, that's not something I subscribe to. But I believe that religion is a vehicle that humans have tried to make ancient spiritual knowledge, you know, digestible through. And so for me, I think it's just bigger than that. And I, in the book, I won't give away too much, but I talk about it from a mathematical perspective, which is rich for me because I hate maths, but I talk about a concept called fractals because fundamentally I believe we're all energy and we're all interconnected. And so we are connected to everything that is, everything that ever was, and each other. And so I think when you live with that philosophy and you know that you are connected to literally the fabric of the universe, the source of everything that is, you know you're powerful and you won't just see the divinity in yourself, you'll see it in other people. And that then is your philosophy for how you should treat other people. So I'm definitely spiritual in that way. I believe that I am connected to something bigger and connected to other people and other things. And I still talk to my grandma. And so that's where I'm at now. I like to practice a lot of the values of forgiveness and love and non-judgment and things like that. But yeah, no religion for me, but I look back on certain parts of it fondly.
Yeah, I love that. Maria, congratulations on everything that you have achieved. I will say for anybody who is interested in the book, it is a great book and it is really a, not just your story, but it is a tool that anybody who picks it up can use to reflect on themselves and their own story and their own journey. Like there is so much kind of, at the risk of saying, you know, self-helpy kind of in there. Like it's inspiring and it's what I love most, I think, is the practicality of it. You know, like, okay, now you go and ask yourself these questions.
Yeah.
You go and journal on this. You go and reflect on this. So I think it really is it's a really valuable resource for anybody, apart from being obviously a really interesting story. So congratulations. Thank you so much for being here today.
That was so generous. It literally fills my heart with so much joy when I hear people describing what they think of the book. And especially you, Kaz, I respect you and your work and your expertise so much. That means the world to me. Thank you for having me and thank you to everybody for listening.
Maria's brand new book, Unbounded, is available right now in all bookstores. You can find out more about Maria at her website, mariathetil.com. She's Maria Thetil on all social media platforms. If you love Crappy to Happy, if you enjoyed this conversation, please do give us a rating and review. Please click the follow button on whatever podcast platform you use. Obviously, come and connect with me. I'm on Instagram, castdun_XO, Facebook, castdun.xo. And I can't wait to catch you next week on another episode of Crappy to Happy. Listener.